stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palka reporting. Executions in Saudi Arabia spawn protests. A crowd of protesters in the Saudi Arabia village of Al Awamiya chanting, "Down with the Saud, death to the Saud," after the beheading of the prominent Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimra. Protests have now bled over into other countries, including India and Iraq. Saudi Arabia carried out its largest mass execution in more than three decades, putting to death 47 people convicted of terrorism, including the Shiite cleric. Nimr al-Nimra was a key figure in Shiite protests that erupted during the 2011 spring. In Iraq, this is Fadi al-Shimar of the Islamic Supreme Council.
He says, "I think Saudi Arabia made a big mistake when it executed al-Nimr, as this will fuel the existing sectarian violence in the region more and more. We have already received promises that Saudi Arabia would pardon Sheikh al-Nimr and his companions, but unfortunately it didn't honor its promises and instead poured oil on the fire. This will spark new unrest in the region." Media outlets say some of those executed Saturdays had ties to al-Qaeda. The Somali militant group al-Shabaab has released a new recruiting video that highlights U.S. police shootings and the call by U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump to ban Muslims from entering the United States. An unidentified al-Shabaab spokesman asserts U.S. Muslims must choose between leaving the country or taking up the cause of the holy war. For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Pro-government fighters in Yemen report that they've killed a senior al-Qaeda leader, Abu Anwar, along with at least two other militants. Al-Qaeda's Yemen branch is considered by Washington to be the most dangerous offshoot of the terror network. Gunmen believed to be Pakistan-based militants launched a day-long attack today on an Indian Air Force base in Punjab State near the border with Pakistan. Officials say at least four attackers and two soldiers were killed during the gun battle. The attack comes amid stepped-up security in India in recent days following an attack on a police official. This comes as potential thawing relations have developed between both India and Pakistan. Anjana Pasricha is in New Delhi and has more on why the attack may have occurred.
The attack comes about a week after Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi made a surprise visit to Pakistan in an effort to revive a flagging peace process. Analysts and officials say peace moves by the political leadership of the two countries in the past have often been followed by an escalation in terror strikes. Nalin Koholi, a spokesman for the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, suggested India will persevere with peace efforts.
Every time there is a movement towards normalization of relationship with Pakistan, these things automatically happen because these are forces that don't want peace between India and Pakistan and also in the region. However, as far as India is concerned, we are constantly going to do our best.
Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
India accuses Pakistan of arming and training insurgents fighting for Kashmir's independence from India and its merger with Pakistan. Iraqi security forces are starting to evacuate civilians who had been trapped and used as human shields by Islamic extremists in the city of Ramadi. VOA's Sharon Bain reports.
The city has been destroyed, the UN's refugee agency told VOA via Skype from Baghdad.
So what we hear from the new arrivals is that indeed it has been difficult for them to get out. There has been sniper fire. There have been protection concerns.
Survivors said that 8 months under Islamic State control were brutal.
When the security was gone from Anbar province, life was dead. Even if they tell you that we were living, this is not true. Death is all we saw.
Iraqi forces said Islamic State militants were using civilians as human shields to escape Ramadi. Those rescued by Iraqi forces have nothing. Humanitarian agencies and NGOs are rushing to help. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Washington.
Israeli police in Tel Aviv are trying to locate the gunman who opened fire outside a bar, killing two people and wounding three others. This eyewitness said we were shaking. We were about eight people hiding in storage so they could not break in. So far, no motive has been given for the attack. It's also unclear if it's tied to the recent wave of Palestinian attacks on Israelis. Joe Palka in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Until now, our political movement still working on that.
Opposition parties in the Congo Republic plan to meet next week to decide whether to participate in the upcoming presidential election.
We have guided them to avoid using those places, and they try to use the open field, the open ground, which can host their crowds.
A new directive by the Ugandan Electoral Commission bans presidential candidates from campaigning in churches and health facilities ahead of the general election.
Nous ne pouvons pas amener notre population.
He says the ideas are good, but behind the ideas there is a hidden agenda, and the UDPS cannot join in the dialogue just for the sake of dialogue.
And the Democratic Republic of Congo's president grants amnesty for prisoners convicted of belonging to a banned movement. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Opposition political parties plan to meet next week to decide whether to participate in the Congo Republic's presidential election, now scheduled for March 20. This following the recent approval of a new constitution. It removed term limit and allows long-term president Denis Sassou Nguesso to seek another term. Last October's referendum, approved by more than 92% of voters, removes a two-term limit and an age limit of 70 for presidential candidates. Pefe Kolela is leader of the opposition Congolese Movement for Democracy and Integral Development Party. He told me that all the opposition political groups are sharply against the referendum that led to the removal of term limits in the constitution.
Until now, our political movement is still working on that. On the 7th. To the 8th of this month, we are going to have a big meeting in order to decide how to do to go to the election.
When your people heard the government has announced that the election will be held and that President Sassou Nguesso is going to run again, how did your people, how did they talk to you about it? Were they happy about the situation?
No, we'll be happy if everything is good. We are looking for the transparency of the process. We are working on that. If we can get the minimum of transparency of the election, we will advise, we will check. We are working on that. It is it's not good what he did, because he has no right to do this. He has no right to this. He has no right to fix the election on the march. So, as I told you, I can't give you a correct answer, final answer, for this purpose.
You and some of the opposition leaders were not happy about the referendum and said that the referendum should not even be held because it was not transparent. So what are you going to do about this referendum that you said should not even be in the first place, and then the constitution cannot be changed that the president has changed so far?
So what I can tell you that now about the referendum. The referendum, we still thinking it was illegal and still illegal. And if we decide to go to the election, it means we are going to win the election. And if you win the election, we are going to cancel the referendum and this constitution. We are going to cancel it. on his gut.
Perfect Kolela is the leader of the opposition Congolese Movement for Democracy and Integral Development Party. He spoke with me from the Congo Republic's capital, Brazzaville. Uganda's Electoral Commission has issued a new directive banning all presidential candidates from campaigning in specific areas, including places of worship, markets, and health institutions. This after calling on the Inspector General of Police, General Kaili Kaihura, to enforce the new rule. But opposition groups rejected the directive as yet another attempt by the Electoral Commission to undermine their campaigns for presidential, parliamentary, and local elections. Jotham Taremwa is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission. He told me the Commission's decision was necessary to ensure a peaceful process ahead of the polls.
It is true, Peter. Electoral Commission communicated and guided the candidates in the presidential race to ensure that while they are on their campaign trails, they don't use markets. Because that's where people are selling their produce. They don't use schools because children have to study, people have to study. They don't use hospitals because there are patients getting treatment and there is need for privacy. So we have guided them to avoid using those places, and they try to use the open fields, the open grounds, which can host their crowds. Yes, we have guided on that. And the Minister of Health has also come out to put out a statement and ensure that candidates know that hospitals and other health facilities are out of bounds for them.
The opposition groups have come out to criticize the latest directive from the Electoral Commission, saying that banning them from campaigning in churches or in hospitals is basically restricting them from reaching out to people and explaining to them their policies ahead of the election. Restricting them to open spaces where they can hold rallies alone might not necessarily be enough. What do you say to that?
How do you go into a hospital, into the wards? You have these sick people, they are mourning and groaning, and you invite all the people outside who are not sick, and you invite the media, and you start addressing people from inside the hospital. Really, that defeats my understanding. It defeats logic. And I thought by utilizing these open fields, that is enough space for people who want to hear their messages to come and join them.
The EC, they said, is doing the bidding of the government because Dr. Esuman Lukwago, a permanent secretary at the Ministry of Health, recently banned campaigns from hospitals, and that this latest directive basically dovetails into what the government is trying to do by stifling the campaigns ahead of the election. What do you say to such criticism?
If I was a member of opposition, I would first apply my common sense before I rush to condemn or blame Electoral Commission. I would first of all question, is it proper for me to go into the hospital wards and turn those health centers into campaign venues? Is that okay? We are all human. We have people who have been sick at some point or who are sick. Even when you visit a hospital, it has hours to visit. You visit with the permission. Even when you get in, you don't shout. How are you going to campaign? By keeping silent to observe the privacy of the sick people. You don't use camera to photograph every other sick patient or area. So really, I think opposition is being unfair here to Electoral Commission, and we are not doing any bidding for NRM. Because we have not banned others and allowed NRM instead use those health facilities as the campaign venue.
Issues about undermining the Constitution have been raised concerning freedom of expression, association, in connection with the new directive banning them specifically in hospitals and in churches and all that. How is the Electoral Commission reacting to these constitutional concerns that the opposition parties have been raising?
That is far-fetched. So to assume that freedom of expression is found in words, we have not stopped anybody from talking to anyone. We are saying, please, if it is a market, people are selling their cassava, they are selling their gonja or tomatoes. Are you going to stand in the middle of the market and you start inviting people to listen to you? There are some wrong elements are going to come and pick people's produce and run away with them. If children are learning, they are in class, do you have to get into the school and you start addressing the public and drawing the attention of the children? Now, for the hospital, it is even worse. People are sick. They are sick. Because they are treating the sick. Now, for you, you want to go there with your cameras and you start addressing the public. Really, they need to be very, very, very serious with those allegations. Nobody has denied them any freedom to speak. They can speak on top of their voices as long as they are not within the hospital ward.
Jotam Taremwa is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Uganda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In South Sudan, governors of newly created state in Western Equatoria are vowing to improve security in their respective regions. They say the partitioning of the state is in line with the government's stated principle of taking services to the people. As VOA fellow Kaltuma Vanessa reports, the governors say they are ready to work for the development of the area under their control.
After a swearing-in ceremony, communities in Meridi State organized a warm reception for their new governor at his residence in Juba. This is a traditional Baka song. The Baka are one of the many tribes who live in the newly created Meridi State. Africano Monday, the new governor of Meridi State says he will implement the plans of the national government and the SPLM party, and security is his number one priority.
My immediate plan is actually to ensure that security prevails, to ensure that there is stability in the state. And the second one is, you know, we have to be a productive people. You know, if we are to work with our heads up, we have to be productive. And productive implies that we have to be self-sufficient in terms of agriculture. We need to be able to reach out to even repair our own roads. We need to reach out and build our own government facilities.
Mande is calling on the people of Meridi to return home and participate in the development of the newly born state. Incumbent caretaker governor of the former Western Equatorial State, who is the new governor of the Gubduwe state, says he is grateful for the leadership of South Sudan for entrusting him to serve the people of Gubduwe. Patrick Zamoy says the petition of Western Equatoria has come at the right time. He says all assets of the state will be shared amongst the three states.
For us, it is not a big deal because we have agreed to share the human resource together. It is not going to be the way people thought was like chasing others from the state, no. It is we are just trying to share the same cake together. Those who are, we find them competent to work in the other state, we release them to work there. Those who feel to stay with their normal business and all this, it is just to their own interest. So it is not a forceful the deployments to other places of work.
Zomoy says Gubduwe State is working to encourage other groups of the Arrow Boys in dialogue to find a lasting solution to the conflict in the state, which has displaced thousands of people. The governor is calling upon the people of this newly created Gubduwe State to work for peace and honor in the name of King Gubduwe.
So for the people of Gubduwe State, I call upon all the people of Gubduwe State to respect the name of our king, who really raised our name to history, so that we also respect and promote the name to history with staying in peace as he was, try to reconcile among ourselves if there were any differences, we put them aside, reconcile ourselves, and embrace the new state.
Governor Zamoy says the people of his state must work together as brothers and sisters to realize the dividends of peace, which he says is development. The Aru boys took up arms against the government, saying they have been deprived of equal opportunities after fighting for the independence of the country for 21 years. Western Equatoria State had been one of the peaceful states in the country up until May of this year, when the veteran groups clashed with the South Sudan Army in Mundri, Meridi, and Yambio. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa in Washington.
The absence of public outcry in Zimbabwe over the deteriorating economy and other issues that have stifled citizens' progress has been puzzling to some. But as Studio 7's Indimi Aike Mwakalyeli reports, analysts say the reason is lack of a strong leadership and fear are partly to blame.
Analysts say the appearance of peace and calm in the nation's streets is not indicative of acceptance of the status quo. Senior consultant Piers Ashley Pagot of the International Crisis Group explains that it's mainly restraint due to fear.
There have been protests, and let's not get away from that, things that there haven't been. Vendors, students, teachers, etc., etc. What we've seen in the last year is that whenever a protest raises its head in an isolated way, the state has come down and moved on those protests very, very quickly.
London-based political analyst Clifford Mashiri agrees and says the disappearance of activist Itai Dzamara 9 months ago left many subdued and in fear of the state security agents, whom he says the government works hard to please.
Before Mr. Mugabe went on holiday, he ensured that the security services had been paid, the CIO, the police, the army, and so on, and particularly, obviously, the top brass. These are the people who are dangerous in the country, and they are the ones who cause people to be very nervous, having seen Dzamara disappearing just in broad daylight. People don't want to sacrifice their lives to a regime that can cause them to disappear.
Professor Shadrack Guto of the University of South Africa in Pretoria says the fear runs deep across all levels.
Zimbabweans, even those who are intellectuals, seem to be scared of really dealing with the situation, and that is the complexity of it all. But a time comes when something begins to ignite the whole uprising. I can't say what it is going to be, but it will be sooner than later.
But even when citizens feel compelled to push for change, analysts say Zimbabwe lacks the strong leadership needed to mobilize people into action. Lecturer Israel Moyo of the Catholic University of Zimbabwe, who's speaking in his own personal capacity, says Zimbabwe's suffering will continue until such leadership appears.
Requires a more active role from the political leaders. It, unfortunately, at the moment, I'm afraid to say that it's fragmented. We have seen political leaders now pursuing individual goals at the expense of national goals. We don't see the leaders now in the world of Joshua Nkomo, even the president, during his prime time.
Director Pedisai Ruhanya of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute concurs.
We have a problem of opposition that is in disarray. We have a problem of the physics. That is in disarray. Even if you look at the liberation struggle, it is leaders, the late Jan Mukwege, the likes of Mugabe himself, people were disgruntled, but the leadership then stood up and organized people to stand for their rights.
Spokesperson Murdoch Chivasa of the National Constitutional Assembly agrees that the country is in a state of paralysis, but disagrees that opposition alone can fix it.
In opposition, we also have our limits. All we can do is to try and influence policy. And in that absence, the people themselves have the power to change government when we get to elections. So still in the hands of the organization.
But ZANU-PF legislator and Central Committee member Joseph Chuma says all talk of forcing the government's hand to change through opposition parties or street demonstrations are counterproductive and devilish.
Look at Libya, for example. Look at Egypt. Look at Tunisia. Look at even Syria. Look at all those places where people have tried to go on the streets and demonstrate.
He says the solution is simple.
There is need for coming up together, focusing together, stopping the blaming game and looking forward to making 2016 a better year. And all that can only happen if we are united, if we are focused.
With 2 years to go before Zimbabwe's scheduled general elections in 2018, analysts say while they are not advocating for civil disobedience, they urge opposition groups to work on gaining citizens' trust and the government to appease the people's suffering. From Washington, this is Ndimyake Mwakalielie.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's president has granted an amnesty for prisoners convicted of belonging to a banned movement, the Bundu Dia Congo, and to prisoners over 70 years old, with some exceptions. He also reiterated his call for a national political dialogue. For VOA, Nick Long has more from Goma in the Eastern DRC.
The Bundu Dia Congo, or BDK, describes itself as a religious movement campaigning for greater autonomy for the Bakongo region in southwestern DRC. Its leader, named Mwanda Nsemi, claims to have been guided by visions. Some of his followers, armed with stones and sticks, clashed with security forces in early 2008. The human rights organization Freedom House said around 100 BDK members died at that time and 150 were arrested. Recently, Mwanda Nsemi backed DRC President Joseph Kabila's plan for a political dialogue and appealed for an amnesty for BDK prisoners, which has now been granted. Kabila has also amnestied prisoners over age 70, except those convicted of offences such as war crimes, corruption, sexual violence, and threatening state security. In an address to the nation on New Year's Eve, Kabila stressed his intention to hold a political dialogue in 2016. Through the political dialogue, he said, we must reach a consensus on various questions in order to lay a new basis for forthcoming elections. A spokesman for the country's biggest opposition party, the UDPS, Augustin Kabuya, commented on Kabila's speech. He says the ideas are good, but behind the ideas there is a hidden agenda, and the UDPS cannot join in the dialogue just for the sake of dialogue. We cannot gloss over what's happening, he says. People are being arrested and convicted unjustly, so how can we trust the regime enough to join in the dialogue? Kabuya questioned whether the promised amnesty would take place. Opposition parties have accused Kabila of calling a dialogue in order to hang on to power beyond his constitutional two-term limit, which is up next December. A political analyst, Felicien Kabamba, told local media recently that Congolese are afraid of what could happen in 2016. He says the head of state has reassured the population that there will not be any bloodshed, but people also expect him to say something about his own future after December next year, and nothing has been said about that. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Next on Reporters Roundtable. Join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable. I'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the big events in Africa in the year 2015. So please join us on Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Your body's amazing, you're perfect, that's it, so Where all the babies, they made a call, they had it fun. As a she's new got, he's not. Now me they sing songs. I'm bad like King Kong. Hey, hey, Calabar. Hey, Calabar. Hey, Calabar. Hey, Calabar.
Like well, it's very long, like food and
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to share my analysis of U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, pay close attention to African opinions on and at the United States. This new year, we all over the world are looking forward to the final year of President Obama. And as we move towards 2016, a number of things are on his plate. One is the continuation of policies he wanted to do for the United States, for the world, and in this particular case, for Africa. The president brought to the United States, for the first time in American history, leaders from the continent of Africa. At that time, these are leaders from independent African countries. The people of Africa have gone through many difficulties with these United States of America. In many ways, if you are looking at world history and how historical leaders can best be seen as actors in a greater drama, depending on how you look at human history. If you are very spiritual, as Christians, we're coming out of Christmas towards the new year, you think in a high way with regard to metaphysics and history. So when we look at American policy towards Africa, you can look at it in three dimensions. Africa as a continent, Africa as a place inhabited by millions of human beings. And then you have to look at Africa as a source of wealth. These United States is now engaging in Africa as a population very much recognized by the United Nations, an institution that did not exist before these United States was created over the last 500 years ago. There were other institutions in Europe, but there was no international body. So as we look at President Obama at this particular moment in world history, we can see the transformation in human relationships over the last 500 years, over the last 100 years, over the last 50 years, and over the last 20 years. And the decision of the president to bring all these African leaders is remarkable. It's unbelievable history. You have African leaders represented at the UN at the founding of the United Nations in California. And we only have two African leaders from Ethiopia and Liberia at the founding of that union. And we have moved forward with Kwame Nkrumah becoming a major leader of the African group with decolonization. So here you talk about America and decolonization of Africa. And of course, America and World War II, America and World War I, America, the end of the slave trade, all these developments are now part of the Obama legacy. And the new developments in American politics cannot be avoided by American historians, American politicians who are looking at how this young man emerged as the president of the United States. And you look at the history of his own father and family in Kenya, settler colonialism in Kenya, independence of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta, and history working in very strange ways. Kenya produced someone at the White House when many other historical events are involved. So when we look at the president bringing to the United States all these African leaders for a summit, it is unbelievable that now the president is moving towards the year 2016 with a new calendar of events for himself. He wants to visit Cuba, which is an other remarkable development in terms of world history. Obama was a little kid at that particular time when John Kennedy was the towering figure of the United States. When we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, Robert Kennedy, and many people who were junior players during the Cuban Missile Crisis would later become Secretary of State of the United States, whether Republican or Democrat were involved in that narrative. So when we look at President Obama and Africa, we can see the summit was a major development because it linked many dots, thereby highlighting America's relations with Africa. So when we look at President Obama's last years, you have several dots to be connected. His calendar of travel is going to be very important. And many reporters, bloggers, Facebook people are going to have thousands of stories to tell. So when we look at the United States and Africa, and we pay attention to African opinions and attitudes toward the United States, we see 2016 a great year, a great of decision. It will affect the economy of the world. And of course, the United States financial power, United States military power, United States political power, best represented by Pentagon, Wall Street, and the activities at the United Nations are going to be the big center of activities. So President Obama's legacy is unchallengeable. And this 2016 will bring many other revelations. And as I look at 2016, I tell my colleagues who are writing about Africa as Africanists or international relations specialists or social psychologists or psychologists to open their eyes and listen attentively to details. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Aidan Utku, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, if the young are not initiated into the village, they will burn it down just to feel its warmth. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the terrible attacks carried out by Boko Haram in Nigeria, December 25th to 28th, as well as other recent attacks in Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. In these attacks, Boko Haram killed dozens of innocent people who were targeted as they went about their daily lives, attending service at a mosque, shopping in a neighborhood market, or simply traveling down a road. We extend our deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of the victims. And we stand with the people of Nigeria and the region in the fight against Boko Haram. Boko Haram has no regard for human life. Its vicious attacks against the innocent, including women and children, and its use of children as human bombs prove its true nature as a purveyor of hate and terror. Although Boko Haram may be able to kill innocent people, it cannot succeed in imposing its will on the people of Nigeria and the other countries of the Lake Chad Basin. The people of this region are not cowed by Boko Haram. They continue to demonstrate remarkable resilience and unshaken resolve in living their lives as they work, take care of their families, and go about day-to-day living. The United States remains committed to helping Nigeria and its neighbors counter Boko Haram's senseless acts of terror. Despite much progress over the past year, due in large part to newly bolstered Nigerian and regional efforts, more work remains to ensure the people of Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria can live in peace. The conflict has affected the lives of communities across the Lake Chad Basin region, with some 2.5 million internally displaced people and more than 170,000 Nigerian refugees forced to flee their homes. The United States provides advisors, intelligence, training, logistical support, and equipment to our African partners as they work to defeat Boko Haram. We also support those affected by Boko Haram's violence through ongoing humanitarian aid and victim support services. The United States will continue working with our partners in the region to identify new opportunities to support their efforts to stop Boko Haram's wanton violence and restore order in the Lake Chad Basin region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.